we talk a lot about trying to find new and emerging use cases to show that blockchain is more than just a fad, that there are real use cases that can emerge from this. I think now more than ever, the ability to sort of harness this technology stack is becoming more and more real for real world businesses.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Join me, Ryan Stubbe, Director of Bitcoin Mining, alongside our team of experts, Jason Ward, the head of FCAT Blockchain and Crypto, Parth Gargava, head of digital asset startups in Fidelity Labs, and Jack Newrider, associate at F Prime Capital. Every week, we roll up our sleeves and delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit the subscribe button for your weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are that of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto's a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently.
Hey, good morning, guys. How are you?
Doing good.
Doing great.
It's Monday, December 9th, as we're recording this one, and we're glad to welcome back Jack after a little bit of a leave. And today we're welcoming Gautam Deva, who is a member of the Fidelity Labs team, a blockchain engineer who works with Parth. So both Parth and Ryan are not able to join us today, but we're excited to have you join us, Gautam. And Jack, what else can we say, but welcome back.
Yeah, excited to be here. Ready to go.
Let's do this.
You look refreshed and well studied. So hopefully life is good.
It is. Yeah, not well slept, but ready to go.
Excellent. So guys, today I think we're going to probably talk about a few different topics. We're going to talk about Marathon Digital in some financing transactions that they're doing. Looks like they're copying what is becoming a common playbook with respect to raising funds for use in the acquisition of digital assets, particularly Bitcoin. Then we're going to talk a little bit about President-elect Trump's nominee for SEC chair, Paul Atkins. Pretty interesting story there. He's a former commissioner under George W. Bush, so he's got some experience. And then lastly, I think we're going to delve a little bit into what has become an interesting yet controversial topic in the crypto asset space in the U.S. That's really with respect to some of the challenges around banking that some crypto companies and crypto participants have experienced, colloquially known as Operation Choke Point 2.0. So we'll save that one for last. But as we get into this, Jack, I'm just curious, after taking a little bit of time, you know, putting your house in order, both literally and figuratively, what are you most excited about looking forward in the blockchain space?
Excited to see continued iteration of basically just new use cases emerging from another sort of iteration of startups and tool sets that have sort of continued to evolve. You see it on, you know, Bitcoin with Bitcoin staking and restaking, and what if we could use Bitcoin collateral to, you know, secure blockchains and networks and make Bitcoin a productive asset? You see it with, you know, the growth of Blockspace and new alt layer ones and layer twos and rollups on Ethereum that are continuing to see traction, like Base, the launch of Monad coming sometime Q1, Q2 potentially of next year. And sort of what that does when the marginal cost to transact on these networks becomes effectively zero or close enough to zero, what kind of use cases can come out of it? And so we talk a lot about trying to find new and emerging use cases to show that, like, blockchain is more than just a fad and more than just circular sort of Ponzi math, that there are real use cases that can emerge from this. And I think now more than ever, you know, the ability to sort of harness this, like, technology stack is becoming more and more real for, like, real world businesses.
Yeah, very, very exciting. You talk about the building and applications. Gautam, you're on the Fidelity Labs team. I know you've been a builder in this space, working alongside Parth and others. What are you thinking about as we wrap up 2024 soon and looking forward to 2025?
Yeah, well, honestly, it's kind of a similar sentiment to Jack in the sense that I'm just, you know, excited to see the sort of community growing. You know, there's a lot of definitely like proposals recently and stuff that have been coming out recently. I actually attended a conference recently called like OP Next, which, you know, typically, you know, when I usually see within the Bitcoin community, it's usually a little bit more quieter, but like, it was really nice to see like a huge community of folks within the Bitcoin space, like proposing all these different, you know, BIPs for like the future, such as like quant proof related for addresses, as well as other things and with covenants and stuff like that. So just seeing like the potential for the network to grow and looking forward to like the improvements within the network and the technology space. So
excellent. And for those who may not be familiar, when you say BIP or BIPs, you're talking about Bitcoin Improvement Protocols. So it is kind of fascinating because on the Bitcoin space, things tend to move slower than in some of the other ecosystems. And obviously that's by design, but great to hear that you had a good experience at you called OP Next. I think sometimes we refer to it as Op Next, but it was really, I think, a sign of the optimism that is generally permeating the industry right now. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that there will be a changing of the guard, so to speak. We have seen that within the U.S., a lot of people over the past several years have had some frustrations, and some of the developers and companies that are launching products have opted to move offshore. But it seems like now that that mood is changing. And I think a big element of that is people's outlook for who might play roles in the next administration. What will the regulators be looking like? And just last week, we saw that Paul Atkins was nominated to become the new SEC chair. So if you guys are not familiar, Mr. Atkins is the CEO of Potomac Partners, which is a consulting firm. He's been a member of the or an advisor to the Digital Chamber since 2020. He has been a member of the Token Alliance, which is a cryptocurrency advocacy group, since 2017. And in addition to having been an SEC commissioner under President George W. Bush, Mr. Atkins was a member of the President's Strategic and Policy Forum group under the first Trump administration. So that's another advisory group. So seasoned veteran. And I have to say, one of the interesting quotes that I saw with respect to this announced nomination came from the former CFTC chair, Chris Giancarlo, otherwise known as Crypto Dad in the U.S. In some circles. But Mr. Giancarlo told Yahoo Finance that he thinks that Mr. Atkins is the absolute right choice. And he's been calling him an advocate for blockchain and digital assets. So contrast that to the current leadership of the SEC. And it does feel like very night and day, so to speak. No disrespect at all intended or meant to the current administration. It's just that they have very different perspectives. And I think if you are monitoring crypto Twitter or other social media circles, or generally some of the regular media, CNBC, Bloomberg, Reuters, the likes, there's a lot of stories and conversations happening now that seem to have an optimistic view. So Jack, maybe I'll turn it over to you and ask you, what's your take on this? You know, you guys are looking at different companies and different players in the building space. I'm curious, are you seeing and hearing similar optimism?
Definitely similar optimism. We're seeing, you know, particularly on, like, I think the staking front has been one where, you know, we have the launch of ETFs with Ethereum, but Ethereum and Solana and other proof of stake assets are relatively less attractive if, you know, you can't take advantage of one of their core capabilities, which is the fact that they're a yield-bearing asset. So a number of folks on, you know, the staking front are optimistic about the potential for approval and integration of staking into some of these, you know, proof of stake ETF-like products. There's optimism within, you know, the DeFi community, where the United States has been largely on the list of sort of barred countries from people being able to use, you know, sort of the front ends for these applications. Technically speaking, various DeFi apps, you can access without anybody's permission. But the actual front ends that make these things accessible and usable for the average person, in most cases, is blocked for U.S. investors, U.S., you know, the average U.S. market participant. I think there's optimism that those types of constraints could slowly, you know, shift and be drawn back over time, which would lead to more potential capital flow and usage and volume of these various networks.
And Gotham, from the participation that you've had with different members of the ecosystem, I'm assuming that you may be hearing similar things.
Honestly, yeah, Jason, like pretty similar to what, you know, Jack has been saying. There's just been a lot of like, you know, really positive front. You know, I feel like from what I've heard, there have been two major consensuses in the fact that if your business operates within like digital asset space, Atkins' appointment could lead to more clear or collaborative regulations. So reducing uncertainty and compliance costs. At least that's what people are suggesting that might happen. And then in terms of like innovative encouragement, you know, the shift away from the old guard, which was with, you know, regulation by enforcement, might foster a little bit more of a innovative friendly environment. So a lot of the sentiment has been, you know, businesses expressing positivity and exploring new opportunity without the fear of a sudden regularity crackdowns.
Yeah, I think it's really important to note that this is, in fact, optimism. It's not yet the reality of people's experiences. And as we know, sometimes signal takes a while to translate into real action. So I think a lot of positive signal here. I think the concerns around, you know, not just regulation by enforcement, but the idea of getting regulatory clarity are still on the table somewhat, but the aspects of being able to go in and engage and try to determine, are you in fact working to construct something that is compliant, or, and actually in some cases, really developing regulations now that are fit for this particular industry, as opposed to sort of retrofitting existing regulation around an evolving marketplace. I think that's the key message I've heard from a lot of people.
Yeah, I think you could also argue that, you know, while this is all still speculative, that on a relative basis, the current environment, while not having been good for Bitcoin, on a relative basis to the rest of crypto, benefited Bitcoin because it had the most regulatory clarity of anything. It seemed as though it was being treated as a commodity that would be squarely under the CFTC. It was the first to have an approved regulated futures market on the CME, the first to have a futures ETP and then a spot ETP. Its product isn't inherently yield bearing. And so the fact that, you know, these types of staking capabilities can't be integrated into an ETP product doesn't disadvantage Bitcoin. In the current environment, obviously something like Ethereum, you know, those products are still less attractive and they've been second to market. And then if you look at sort of the broader landscape beyond Ethereum, on a relative basis, all of those assets have far less regulatory clarity, which leads to, you know, less traditional and in particular institutional investors being able to touch or access those markets and being comfortable with potentially the career risk that exists when the SEC or the CFTC hasn't opined on these assets. I think there's a sense of optimism that obviously on a relative basis, this could be even better for, you know, the longer tail of crypto. And that's really where, you know, key innovations and sort of the next iteration of, you know, what will come of crypto is probably going to stem from, right? We know what Bitcoin is. And like, I think all of us here and a lot of the listeners see value in Bitcoin as this emerging, aspiring store of value like asset. But it's meant not to iterate and innovate, whereas the rest of crypto is going to iterate, innovate. Probably 99% of it will die. But from that innovation is where like the key unlocks of what crypto could bring beyond just Bitcoin are. And obviously that's been stifled up until this point. I think there's a lot of optimism that that could change. It might take some time, but as we start to get potentially some of these rules of the road.
Yeah, Jack, I think it's a great call out because when you think about the winners and losers, although it's really to be determined, there's no questioning that in the early days post-election, Bitcoin has been a dominant force. And, you know, it pushed up essentially $40,000 over the past month. I heard some stat this morning. I think that the since the election, Bitcoin traded ETPs, spot Bitcoin ETPs are up in assets something like $10 billion. And I think it's well over $100 billion now at this point in terms of the assets in those particular types of exchange traded products. But you're right, the long tail, and I'm going to include Ethereum there for the time being, that has a lot of room to shake out. So really interesting. I think you were talking about yield. Maybe we could take advantage of that in the Bitcoin discussion to talk about what's going on with Marathon Digital, which happens to be a Bitcoin miner. Seems like they're also active in the financing space. Gotham, can you tell us a little bit about what happened there? And Jack, maybe can you fill in some of the details as we go?
Yeah, so basically for the Marathon Digital, basically they announced on Wednesday that for a sale of like $850 million in convertible notes to purchase like outstanding debt and then purchase spot Bitcoin. For those of you that don't know what convertible note is, it's a type of debt that can be converted into equity at a later date. Think of it as kind of like a loan, but you can turn it into a stock if certain conditions are met later down the line. And basically, you know, they're raising funds to kind of refinance existing debt to acquire more Bitcoin, essentially. And the implications of that, you know, especially long-term with Bitcoin value, right? It's kind of similar. It kind of mirrors MicroStrategy's approach a little bit in terms of obviously accumulating Bitcoin as like a reserve asset. So, you know, in terms of like thoughts, I'd like to hear what, you know, Jack has to say kind of about that.
Yeah. And, Marathon's not the only one doing it, right? I think we just saw this morning Riot announced that they had filed that they're going to do a $500 million convertible offering. I think we've seen similar from other Bitcoin miners as well. And then obviously MicroStrategy, which has a small software business, has been doing, you know, significant amount of convertible debt offerings as well as at the money equity issuance to buy more Bitcoin. And you know, what you're seeing is, you know, some of these public companies with their treasuries are becoming sort of these large concentrated buyers of Bitcoin. In some cases, you know, $500 million, $1 billion plus that's being deployed over the course of like a week's period of time. I think a lot of people are asking, like, where is all of the liquidity from the sell side coming from? Because we haven't seen like super elastic, you know, price response where the price of Bitcoin moves, you know, $5,000 or $10,000 as a result of a couple $1 billion of inflow. I don't know the answer to that question of like who's the seller, where these billions of dollars are coming from. I'd be curious if anybody does have information on that. But what we're seeing here at the moment is these convertible debt offerings, like Gotham, you mentioned that they're debt, but they come with an option for the equity. And so in the downside scenario, the holders of convertible debt are debt holders. In the upside scenario, they effectively get a call option at a certain price, strike price of that equity. And so if the price of Bitcoin rises and the underlying business, of course, would theoretically rise in tandem, they would be capturing that upside. And so what happens is these convertible notes are able to be offered at like extremely low interest rates because the options are so valuable that's coming with that debt offering. And I think a lot of that has to do with the way that these options markets are being priced at the moment. There's a lot of implied volatility associated with Bitcoin because it's a volatile asset. And so therefore, the options price, the premium that has to be paid for these options is hefty to begin with. But we also see a lot of speculation from like retail is sort of presumed to be the people that are speculating on the options of these crypto equities that are issuing these convertible debt offerings. And so what that does is it makes sort of the implied option that comes with the convertible debt to be like super pricey or juicy, to be worth a lot. And you're seeing a lot of convertible ARB funds that are presumably coming in and buying this convertible debt. And then in many cases, if you're a converted ARB shop, you don't care about the price movement of Bitcoin. You care about the fact that you can take a delta neutral position and sort of lock in gains associated with that position by selling those call options to be delta neutral on the position. And so right now, I do think a lot of the ability for these companies to issue this convertible debt is driven by the fact that the options market is pricing these calls so expensively. And I don't know how long that can persist, probably a lot longer than you would assume it can persist because it's sort of a bit of a market irrationality that should subside at some point in time, at least sort of if you look at it just from an academic context, it shouldn't exist forever, but it continues to persist. And so we're going to continue to see this happening. I would just draw a little bit of concern that every single time it continues to happen, especially if it's amongst a small handful of these convertible debt issuers, these businesses, you'll become more levered to the price of Bitcoin because they're buying Bitcoin with the proceeds and they're adding debt. And so if the price of Bitcoin drops, then their debt to equity rises and the potential for them to in the future become a forced seller rises. I don't think that's necessarily like a huge concern for some of these businesses at the moment, but as it continues, these are concentrated buyers of Bitcoin that are, driving the price upwards at the moment, but that could become reflexive to the downside in a, volatility to the downside type scenario.
So Jack, I love the depth that which you can get into there. And I think one of the fascinating things is these convertible debt offerings are sometimes priced with 0% coupon. So the cost of the borrow at this point is effectively zero. But what I also heard you say is there are sophisticated players in this space that are creating what you call a delta neutral position, which I'll say is essentially a hedged position locking in gains while others are exposed to higher volatility. And they may not necessarily be positioned to withstand that volatility long term. And I'm not saying these companies at all. I'm saying market participants. They could be retail investors. They could be institutions. We don't really know. But one thing is for sure, there is an appetite for volatility today. And I only say that because there are a number of funds that are popping up that are leverage funds looking at single stocks. And they, in the case of MicroStrategy, there's a handful where you can essentially buy an exchange traded product that seeks to return a multiple of the underlying, either to the upside or inversely. So again, that's creating some additional opportunity in the options marketplace, but really it feels like risk on top of risk.
Yeah, that further skews options pricing. And for convertible ARB funds, like this is the dream investment. That's why I think you're seeing oversubscription to all these convertible debt offerings. It's not necessarily that these funds want exposure to the price of Bitcoin. I'm sure there are some that want that, but many of them are looking at it and saying we can be delta neutral, effectively be agnostic to the price movement of the asset, be higher in the capital stack than the equity, and we can sell off the upside. And there's basically an implied interest rate that you could back out from these things, and it's irrationally priced. That's why they're able to price it at 0% and still have a ton of demand. And maybe the other thing worth noting, because we were talking about Marathon and Riot, is it is an interesting quirk of crypto miners, of these Bitcoin miners, where they want to leverage themselves and buy more of the asset. It's not enough to just mine the asset and then hold the proceeds. By the way, which like gold miners and traditional miners, they do the exact opposite of, right? Their risk management practices are like, we sell forward futures. I don't know, I'm sure the duration of those futures and how far out they sell their commodity varies based on the industry and specifics to those companies, but they hedge out the risks of the underlying volatility of the asset that they're mining. And in Bitcoin, we're seeing the exact opposite. And I would just say, it seems like the amount of risk that these companies are taking is maybe not being accurately taken account for. I don't know if you guys feel differently, but like there are reasons why existing industries hedge out the price of their commodity. And in our industry, with companies that exist at this size, have only existed for a handful of years with an extremely volatile asset. And we have seen miners taken out to the woodshed, so to speak, before. And now they're sort of levering up with additional leverage to buy more of the underlying commodity. I do question like the sustainability of that practice, I guess.
It's a really interesting set of behaviors. I would sort of summarize it maybe overly simplistically as saying it's a high conviction play for them. And perhaps they're looking at a window of time and saying that, they should strike while the iron is hot and adjust in the future as the new environment continues to unfold. And maybe using that new environment as a pivot point. I'd like to talk for a few minutes about the banking challenges that many in the crypto industry have faced. And, you know, some have referred to it as Operation Choke Point 2.0. I think that is, we want to be very clear that that is not an official statement. That is just a collective tagging, if you will, by participants in the industry. But what it has come to represent is frustrations with many people and companies having their bank accounts closed, or in some cases having applications for accounts be denied without reason. And a lot of the speculation has been because they are active in the crypto space. And we've seen many people speaking about this. You know, Nick Carter has been very vocal about this from Castle Island Ventures. Caitlin Long, CEO of Custodia, has been very vocal, particularly as her company pursues its action to acquire essentially a license to access the Fed, but they've run into issues with their regulators and the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. That continues to unfold. And then recently you had Mark Andreessen on the Joe Rogan podcast talking about a number of their portfolio companies that went through these challenges of banks, either shutting down or denying applications for customers. And guys, I saw reporting over the weekend that a research firm that was hired by Coinbase to assist in one of their legal suits has acquired access to some internal documents from the FDIC that conveyed that the FDIC was asking some of their member banks to put a pause on activity with crypto companies. And I think just that information in a bubble is supportive of this idea that perhaps companies have been isolated. But I think there's a lot of context that may be missing. And keep in mind, this is in the wake of FTX, a lot of questions about different international players. So some I've heard have been talking about, particularly there was a person on CNBC, I think it was earlier today, talking about, in their opinion, there is no 2.0. There has just been questions about rules and regulations, and do you have the right AML or KYC rules? Is it a question of compliance? I think time will help us all understand where that is applicable and where it may not be. But this idea of limiting access to the banking system really can have a constraining effect, and I think that's a lot of what's pushed people to explore opportunity to offshore. So I'm interested in your take, Gotham. You know, as you think about this and are a builder in this space, it seems like, you know, getting access to financing, being able to interact with companies and being able to know that you have the ability to make payroll, it's a very important aspect to this. And hopefully on a go-forward basis, I think we saw Representative French Hill talking about the House Financial Services Committee holding some inquiries into this and the go forward. I'm curious, Gotham, your take, and then Jack, anything you guys want to add to this?
Yeah, and also it is important to stress, Jason, that again, like, these are unconfirmed allegations, but
exactly,
there will probably likely be a little bit more information later down the line, to carry out an investigation. And if it is true, then that's a pretty, big deal. I hope that with this, it helps to provide and establish more of a crypto-friendly, regulatory framework later down the line. You know, we've seen, as you mentioned, with prominent fingers like Mark and, Brian Armstrong, they've shared experiences with debanking and kind of suggested, coordination efforts to kind of limit the crypto industry, right? So, which further supports those claims. But I hope that this can lead to more, clear regulations, more predictive regulations, and help reduce operational risk with crypto businesses, right? Because, we do see that a lot, like when working with these different crypto technologies. And I think it's important to not restrict, but also encourage like innovation and the growth in the industry, right?
Yeah, totally. And I think it's a bit ironic that like the lineage of Tether came into existence because like crypto exchanges and people that wanted to use or do something with their crypto, get into a stable asset and access dollars from their crypto, were having trouble doing so. And so Tether launched a stable coin that would become the largest, I don't know what it is, $130+ billion in assets, and would later lead to innovations on stablecoins and other stablecoins being launched. The largest RWA and arguably one of the largest use cases in crypto came out of the fact that accessing banking for crypto companies was effectively impossible. And at the moment, it's still difficult, but maybe not as hard as it used to be. I think we're headed in sort of a positive direction in terms of the connectivity between crypto and banking infrastructure. But ironically, stablecoins kind of came out of the fact that that connectivity didn't exist to begin with, and now is becoming core technology that I think lots of banks and, you know, traditional finance is looking at as, you know, should we launch one? What should we do with these existing stablecoins? How do we, you know, play in this field? And all of that stems from the fact that there were problems there.
Yeah, Jack, it's, I think using the word ironic is completely appropriate. And, you know, thinking about the fact that stablecoins can help persist the utility of the dollar as a global reserve currency. You know, I think a lot about past reporting that we've done and information we've shared about challenges related to some of the banks. And, you know, we saw back almost 2 years ago now, we saw Silicon Valley Bank had run into some liquidity challenges around the aspects of the assets it held. So asset liability mismatch, apparently due to duration of some of the holdings it had. But then Silvergate and Signature Bank were two banks that supported the digital asset industry in the U.S. that offered their clients access to be able to make money movements 24/7. So you had Silvergate Exchange Network and you had Signet. And these were two, in effect, internal networks that allowed for the movement of value outside of traditional wire hours, which are, in effect, what stablecoins do. And as these two exchange networks were, I'll call them retired, to be polite, we saw an increase in the use of stablecoins and the issuance of stablecoin in terms of like total value. So I do think that we're going to see probably more adoption of stablecoins generally because of the utility of them, whether it's as a trading pair or for payments. But generally speaking, I think that there will be a lot of interesting things to follow, whether it's coming out of a House investigation or just increasing awareness around the need for strong compliance controls, the AML, the KYC application, for some of these companies that may be looking for banking. That may have been the reason they haven't had access, or maybe it will be the catalyst that gives them more access in the future. So again, I wanted to sort of wrap up here because I think it gives us another item to think about as an opportunity as opposed to the challenge that has been to date. So hopefully this will be something that catalyzes future growth for the industry, particularly onshore in the US.
Yeah, I think with banking can be a total game changer for this industry and for the use of crypto and blockchain for payments use cases in particular. Obviously, banks are very important to banking and or to payments use cases. And so
and tokenize real world assets. You start trading other assets and you need a cash on chain instrument. Could be stable coins, could be, you know, tokenized treasuries. You could end up seeing asset for asset type of swapping going on in the future, referencing traditional financial services applications. So,
yeah, I think there's an argument that we're headed into potentially just a very different era for crypto because it had to live in isolation before. And it seems like it may not be in such isolation moving forward.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, we could see improvement to, you know, access to banking and, you know, especially with these like incoming, you know, administration progresses, we could see a lot of like support for the regulatory framework or certain environment and, you know, reducing these operational risks to foster a more stable business climate.
Absolutely. As we wrap up, I'm reminded of a favorite song of mine, Coming In From the Cold, and perhaps the crypto industry coming out of this last crypto winter, things being positive, maybe as an industry will be coming in from the cold. So thank you guys very much for joining today. Look forward to catching up again soon.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2024 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.